And welcome to another episode of Unearthing Paranormalcy, the podcast that digs into the paranormal and tries to find normalcy in the topic. I'm Amy.
I'm Dave.
I'm Chad.
And Eli is at home recovering from surgery. We wish him well. Hope that he gets better soon. As soon as we find out more from pathology reports, we'll have some updates for listeners. I don't know if you guys can hear this. We hear it really loud here. We have got massive wind going on, but it makes for a nice ambiance. So before we start with this week's episode, we have any business to discuss. You want to talk about your green mushroom project?
Sure. I have some words from Lux Estrada concerning the Green Mushroom Project. Resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times.
If you want to find out more about the Green Mushroom Project, you can listen to our last episode or get with Dave on Facebook or Instagram. And
yeah, just shoot me a DM about it.
So this week, we are going to get into aliens.
Wait, it's ghosts.
And we are going to cover Travis Walton.
Ooh.
Dave, take it away.
This is one of the more famous cases of alien abduction. During my research for this episode, I found a website, traviswalton.com. A great source of information with stories, quotes, and details provided by Travis Walton himself. I thought it best that we should just let him tell his story in his own words. This is an excerpt from the book Fire in the Sky by Travis Walton, describing the incident. It was the morning of Wednesday, November 5th, 1975. To us, the seven men working in the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, it was an ordinary working day. There was nothing in that sunny fall morning to foreshadow the tremendous fear, shock, and confusion we would be feeling as darkness fell. We were working on the Turkey Springs tree thinning contract. Basically, thinning involves spacing and improving the thick strands of smaller trees to allow for their faster growth. That day, November 5th, we were cutting a fuel reduction strip up the crest of a ridge running south through the contract. Fuel reduction is the process of cutting the thinning slash into lengths and piling it up to be burned in the wet season. The boss, Mike Rogers, was 28, the oldest of the seven men. He had been bidding these thinning contracts from the Forest Service for 9 years. That had been long enough to learn, the hard way, all the tricky pitfalls of the business. He was getting to where he could fairly consistently gauge the price per acre and would underbid the other contractors and still allow profit margin. Turkey Springs was the best contract, profit-wise, Mike had ever been awarded. In fact, it paid the highest acre price he had ever received. When we are piling, some of the men run saws while the others pile. I was running a saw, as were Alan Dallas and John Goulet. Dwayne Smith, Kenneth Peterson, and Steve Pierce were piling behind the cutters as we worked our way up the strip. Dwayne Smith wasn't aware of it. I had to be constantly careful to fell my trees so as to miss him. His inexperience, or maybe over-eagerness, was causing him to work too close to me, instead of allowing a little accumulation of slash to put some distance between us. But at least he was trying. I could not say the same for Steve. I could see Mike far back down the strip resacking some sloppy piles to bring them up to specification. Steve took advantage of the boss's absence to rest his can momentarily on a handy log. He was ordinarily a good worker, but was a little disgruntled today because Mike had blamed him for some bad piles Dwayne had made. I was trying to keep my distance from the other men, but we were coming together on a thick place to one side of the piling strip. The noise of my own saw is loud enough, even with earplugs, without revving all three of them in one spot. Just then I saw a shadow and jumped barely in time to escape a falling tree. I looked to see who had cut it. Alan. His mocking grin let me know it was no accident. I didn't let on that he had needled me. I moved further up the strip to work. Alan always cut like a crazy man. He was a faster sawyer than anyone out there, even me. His speed helped Acre production, but it kept him from being up to working every day. His uncontrollable temper was possibly what made him saw like that, taking his anger out on the trees. Alan had nearly come to blows with almost everyone on the crew, including me. He had a way of picking fights he never finished. Although our differences were forgotten as far as I was concerned, and we were friendly on the job, I suspected that Alan might have one or two lingering bad feelings towards me. The afternoon sun was starting to cool as it began angling steeper down in the west. In the mountains, sundown comes early. It gets dark very quickly when Old Soul slips behind the trees and out of sight behind the high ridges. The gathering chill was beginning to numb my nose. With summer ending, it was starting to get down to 5 or 10 degrees at night. I worked a little faster to ward off the chill, eagerly anticipating the reprieve of the day's conclusion. Not long to go before we could head for home. Sunset had been 15 minutes earlier, but we kept cutting in the waning light. I checked my watch again. It was 6 o'clock at last. Mike was still down the hill a little way, picking up and repiling. I yelled and took the liberty of giving the stop work signal. The sound of the saws died, the final echoes absorbed into the deepening dusk. We loaded the chainsaws and gas and oil cans in the back of the 65 International. After arranging the gas cans so they would not tip over and leak on the bumps, Mike slammed the tailgate tightly. The decrepit pickup groaned on its tired old suspension as everyone piled in. There was Dwayne by the left rear door, John and Steve in the middle, and Alan by the right rear door. In the front, I sit by the door, riding shotgun. Ken sat in the middle, and of course Mike was driving. The seven of us usually sat in the same place every day. Non-smokers in front, smokers in back. Mike started the old pickup, and we climbed north up the ridge toward the rim road. It was 6:10. Barring any breakdowns, we should be home before 7:30. We left the windows down so we could cool off some. We were still warm from laboring, in spite of the evening air. Mike, Ken, and I do not smoke, and we prefer to inhale genuine, unadulterated air. The four in the back seat lit up as soon as we were in the truck, eager after hours without a cigarette. The fresh air coming in my window was bracing. We usually nap on the way to work every morning, but none of us ever feels drowsy on the way back to town. The rousing activity on the job hones a keenness that stays with us all the way home. Bouncing over the water bars in the road, humps of dirt that prevent the road from washing out in the rainy season, the truck kept bottoming out on its springs with a dull clunking sound. The fellows started cracking jokes about the pickup. Just then, my eye was caught by a light coming through the trees on the right, 100 yards ahead. I idly assumed that the glow was the sun going down in the west. Then it occurred to me that the sun had set half an hour ago. Curious, I thought it might be the light of some hunter's camp there. Headlights, or maybe a fire. Some of the guys must have caught sight of it too, because the men on the right side of the truck had fallen silent. As we continued driving up the road toward the brightness, we passed inside of it for an instant. We barely got a glimpse through gnarled branches before we rolled past the opening in the trees.
"Son of a—"
Alan started. "What the hell was that?" I asked. My eyes strained to make sense of the glimmering through the dense stand of trees blocking our vision. From my open window, I could see the yellowish brilliance washing across our path onto the road another 40 yards ahead. Intrigued, I was impatient to get past the intervening pines. From the driver's seat, Mike could not look up with the proper angle without leaning way over.
"What do you guys see?"
he demanded curiously. Dwayne answered,
"I don't know, but it looked like a crashed plane hanging in a tree."
Finally, our growing excitement spurred Mike into wringing out what little speed the pickup could still achieve on the incline. We rolled past the interweaving evergreen thicket to where we could have an unobstructed view of the source of the strange radiance. Suddenly, we were electrified by the most awesome, incredible sight we had ever seen in our entire lives.
"Stop!"
John cried out.
"Stop the truck!"
As the truck skidded to a dusty halt in the rocky road, I threw open the door for a clearer view of the dazzling light.
"My God!"
Alan yelled.
"It's a flying saucer!"
Mike shut off the engine. We watched, spellbound. The men on the left side of the truck leaned over so they could see. There, a mere 20 feet above the ground, a strange golden disc hovered silently. Our attention was riveted on that object, poised in the air. Impaled by the sight, we were held transfixed for one long, silent moment that felt like an eternity. The cold, jarring reality of what we were witnessing struck fear and awe to the core of every one of us. Suddenly, beholding its vivid, magnificent structure summoned all emotions at once. You could almost hear our hearts pounding above that suspended instant of silence. Less than 30 yards away, the metallic craft hung motionless, 15 feet above a tangled pile of longing slash. The craft was stationary, hovering well below the treetops near the crest of the ridge. The hard, mechanical precision of the luminous vehicle was in sharp contrast to the primitive ruggedness of the dark surroundings. Its edges were clearly defined. The golden machine was starkly outlined against the deepening blue of the clear evening sky. The soft yellow haze from the craft dimly illuminated the immediate area with an eerie glow. Under the weird light, the encircling forest took on bizarre hues that were very different from its natural colors. The trees, the brush, and the grass all reflected subtle, peculiar new shades. I estimated the object to have an overall diameter of 15 or 20 feet. It was 8 or 10 feet thick. The flattened disc had a shape like that of two gigantic pie pans placed lip to lip, with a small round bowl turned upside down on the top. Barely visible at our angle of sight, the white dome peeked over the upper outline of the ship. We could see darker stripes of a dull silver sheen that divided the glowing areas into panel-like sections. The dim yellowish light given off by the surface had the luster of hot metal, fresh from a blast furnace. There was no visible antenna or protrusions of any kind, nothing that resembled a hatch, ports, or window-like structures could be seen. There was no motion and no sound from the craft. It almost appeared to be dead in the air. I glanced from one to another stricken face. Turning back to that impaling spectacle in the air, I was suddenly seized with the urgency to see the craft at close range. I was afraid it would fly away and I would miss the chance of a lifetime to satisfy my curiosity about it. I hurriedly got out of the truck and started toward the hovering ship. The men were alarmed by my sudden action.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Mike demanded in a loud, harsh whisper. Placing my feet quietly, I quickly stalked closer to the mysterious vehicle. Stepping over a low-leaning fir sapling, I carefully picked my way through the opening in the trees. I put my hands in my pockets in response to the cooler twilight air outside the truck.
"Hey, Travis!"
the men warned insistently. I stopped walking for a long, hesitant moment. I paused and turned to look back at the six men staring questioningly at me from the truck. The sober realization of what I was doing abruptly heightened the doubt I was already wrestling with. What should I do? I asked myself. Maybe I'm being foolhardy, I told myself. I won't get too close. But what if there's somebody inside that thing? I faltered. Finally, I reassured myself with, I can always run away.
Famous last words.
I was committed. Without replying to the guys, I resolutely turned and continued my brazen approach. I moved more slowly, cautiously, covering the remaining distance in a half crouch. I straightened up as I entered the dim, circular halo of light softly reflecting onto the ground under the craft. I was about 6 feet from being directly underneath the machine. Bathed in the yellow aura, I stared up at the unbelievably smooth, unblemished surface of the curving hull. I was filled with a tremendous sense of awe and curiosity as I pondered the incomprehensible mysteries possible within it. I had become aware of a barely audible sound coming from the ship. I could detect a strange blend of low and high-pitched mechanical sounds. There were intermittent, high, piercing, beeping noises overlaid on the distant, low, rumbling sound of heavy machinery. The strange tones were so mixed that it was impossible to compare them to any sound I could remember ever hearing.
Travis, get away from there!
Mike yelled to me. I shot a fleeting look at the pickup parked in the road, then turned my attention back to studying the incredible ship. Suddenly, I was startled by a powerful, thunderous swell in the volume of the vibrations from the craft. I jumped at the sound, like that of a multitude of turbine generators starting up. I saw the saucer start wobbling on its axis with a quickening motion, in a pattern like the erratic spin of an unstabilized top. The same side continued to face me as the craft remained hovering at approximately the same height while it wobbled. I ducked into a crouch when a tremendously bright blue-green ray shot from the bottom of the craft. I saw and heard nothing. All I felt was the numbing force of a blow that felt like a high-voltage electrocution. The intense bolt made a sharp cracking or popping sound. The stunning concussion of the foot-wide beam struck me fully in the head and chest. My mind sank quickly into unfilling blackness. I didn't even see what hit me. But from the instant I felt that paralyzing blow, I did not see, hear, or feel anything more. The men in the truck saw my body arch backwards, arms and legs outstretched as the force of the blow lifted me off the ground. I was hurled backward through the air 10 feet. They saw my right shoulder hit the hard, rocky earth of the ridgetop. My body landed limply and lay motionless, spread out on the ground.
I got him,
Steve yelled. Dwayne screamed.
Let's get out of here.
Alan shrieked hysterically.
Get this son of a bitch moving.
Mike did not need to be asked. He was already desperately groping, fumbling around for the ignition switch. His shaking fingers finally seized the key. The engine roared to life. Mike gunned the truck up the boulder-strewn track. He frantically spun the steering wheel one way, then the other, navigating the torturous road.
Is it following us?
He yelled over his shoulder. Nobody answered.
Is it after us?
He shouted again. When again no reply came, he turned to see the looks of stupefied shock on the faces of his crew. Their pale faces stared straight ahead blankly. In reaction to the unbelievable horror of what they had witnessed, 6 hardened woodsmen were reduced to mindless terror. Mike was fearful that the saucer was pursuing them. He put his head out the open window to try and see behind, and was stung in the face by the sharp pine needles of a passing limb. He kept hitting boulders and other obstacles in his attempts to look behind. The erratically vibrating rearview mirrors only produced a blurred, flickering image. A faint yellow glow in the blackness. Goaded by a surge of terror, he stomped on the gas pedal. The rattling truck shot forward at 35 miles an hour. far too fast for the condition of that road. A passing limb slammed into the right rear view mirror, bending it uselessly to the side of the truck. The old International went flying through the air over the dirt ramp of a high water bar. As it landed, the pickup smashed down destructively on its weakened springs with a terrible crash. The powerful jolt of metal on metal brought Mike to his senses. He was gripped by the sudden, icy realization. If the truck broke down, they would be stranded and at the mercy of the unknown threat they were fleeing. He slowed the truck down to 10 miles an hour. He was grateful to find the truck still working, capable of carrying them away. The truck passed behind dense thickets of pine saplings, and the ship was once more lost from sight. In diverting his attention from his driving, Mike made the wrong approach to a water bar on the road. It was the largest of them, and the last one before the rim road, 100 feet further on. Mike stopped the truck to back up and make another run at it.
It doesn't look like it's after us.
Mike shuddered as he shoved the gear shift into reverse. The pause broke the men out of their shocked silence. They began to jabber hysterically. Instead of continuing over the obstacle, they sat there with the engine running. They struggled to collect themselves and decide what to do. Everyone was yelling at once in a confusion of high-pitched shouting. Mike anxiously asked,
I saw him falling back, but what happened to him?
Man, a blue ray just shot out of the bottom of that thing and hit him all over. It just seemed to engulf him.
Ken's voice was solemn with awe.
Good hell! It looked like he disintegrated!
Dwayne exclaimed.
No, he was in one piece!
Steve contradicted.
I saw him hit the ground.
I do know one thing. It sure looked like he got hit by a lightning or something.
Dwayne returned.
I heard a zap. I guess if he had touched a live wire.
Hey, man, we better go back,
someone said.
No way, man. I ain't going back there,
said someone else. As the men argued, Mike interjected.
Let's build a fire so the guys who don't want to go can stay here in the clearing while the rest of us go back there.
Just as Mike was about to get the gas out of the back, they were startled by the sudden approach of headlights coming west on the rim road. The dim outline of a camper pickup could be seen passing in the dark.
Let's go catch that pickup and get help,
John yelped excitingly. Everyone piled in the right side of the truck. As Mike went around the driver's side of the truck, he exclaimed,
Look, did you see that?
The men scrambled to look. One of them ran to the front of the pickup.
What was it?
He asked. Mike told them he thought he had briefly seen the outline of the golden disc through the trees to the south. It had raised itself vertically to treetop level and streaked away toward the northeast at incredible speed. They got in the truck. Mike ankled the forgiving old pickup over the high water bar and pulled out onto the rim road, heading west. The men argued on, rehashing what had happened. They were still arguing a mile down the road where they reached the turnoff that went north to Heber. There, they finally worked their way around to the inevitable conclusion. Mike turned the truck around at the turnoff. He said firmly,
This truck is going back. Anybody who doesn't want to come, get out right here and now and wait. We've been acting like a bunch of cowards. We're all scared. There's no denying that. We got to do what we should have done in the first place.
The embarrassed men no longer protested returning to the site. Even if they were still reluctant, they were ashamed to say so. Also, the prospect of waiting alone at the turnoff in the dark was much worse than going back together. Their courage had been reinforced by the time and distance away from the site. However, as they turned left off the rim road toward the original scene, their apprehension began steadily to rebuild. They began speculating on the dreadful possibilities of what they might find when they returned. The nearer they got, the more anxious they became.
Hold it! It was right back there,
Ken exclaimed. Somebody suggested pulling the truck around and pointing the headlights towards the log pile above which they had seen the hovering ship. They backed up and pulled in, driving over the first sapling leaning in the way. Their eyes searched the area illuminated by headlights, they found nothing.
We're just going to have to get out and look around,
said Mike. They searched first in the security of the headlights. Everyone stayed together, huddling close to Mike, who carried the only flashlight. The flashlight beam probed into the night, examining every dark shape. They searched behind every log, bush, and stump. They called repeatedly,
Travis!
Travis!
Except for their calls, the woods were deathly quiet. They searched further north, as Alan had suggested. They searched beyond the crest of the ridge and further south. They found no sign anywhere. No foreign objects or unusual markings. No burns, pad impressions, or disturbed ground. Not a trace of tracks, and no evidence of a struggle. The longer they continued, the more worried Mike became, more overcome with emotion. He stumbled, then stood, looking down, struggling to control his feelings. The loss of his friend, his guilt at driving away, and the pressure of the leadership being demanded of him all became too much to bear for a moment. Finally, Mike managed to regain his composure.
Okay, you guys. We're not doing any good here. Let's go.
They got in the truck and began the long drive back to Heber. The memory of what they had so recently witnessed left them with a spectrum of strong emotional reactions. Then Ken voiced the one thought they had all avoided so far.
We're going to have to tell the authorities about this.
Again, that was from Fire in the Sky by Travis Walton. I have more for you later. But right now, the focus is going to be on these other six men from the logging crew. Mike Rogers, Alan Dallas, John Goulet, Dwayne Smith, Kenneth Peterson, Steve Pierce. Then we have law enforcement officers, Deputy Sheriff Chuck Ellison, Sheriff Marlene Gillespie, and Under Sheriff Ken Copeland. Now, I had to pull and dig through many sources to get the rest of the story compiled, but the level of detail, you know, I love to present.
So, that's pretty darn intense there, by the way, before we get into the rest of this.
Yeah.
If you've seen the movie Fire in the Sky, it is pretty darn close to the depiction he has in that book.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw it for the first time this week, so.
Yeah, me too.
I was a Fire in the Sky virgin, and now I feel like an expert. So let's get into this investigation.
So at 7:35 p.m., Mike Rogers' truck pulls up to a payphone. Ken Peterson calls the Navajo County Sheriff's Office to report Travis missing. When Deputy Sheriff Chuck Ellison shows up, he senses the shock of these young men, notices they have bloodshot eyes and tear-stained faces. Later in interviews, he said part of his investigation was at this point getting near each of the six men as close as he could to try and smell for alcohol or marijuana as they told their story.
I don't smell no skunk. I think you're good.
Ellison radios the sheriff, Marlon Gillespie, and requests a deputy to go to Travis's home. Less than an hour later, Sheriff Gillespie and the undersheriff, Ken Copeland, arrive. Gillespie was described as a no-nonsense type of man who had seen and heard it all. He told the young man he had had his own UFO sighting before, so it's not far-fetched, but he is naturally skeptical. The three officers, Mike, Ken, and Alan, head back to the site of the incident. They find nothing. No footprints, no disturbed branches, no evidence at all that either them or a spaceship had been anywhere nearby. They decided maybe they'll have a better observation first thing in the morning. Under Sheriff Ken Copeland and Mike Rogers went to the home of Mary Keller, Travis's mother. When they tell her Travis was zapped and abducted by a UFO, Ken Copeland thought it was suspicious how calm she was. Mary asked to be driven over to her daughter's Allison Neff's house, where they called Dwayne, Travis's older brother, who has the same name as Dwayne on the logging crew. So I'll refer to Dwayne from the logging crew as Dwayne Smith, or just Smith from here on. Dwayne, Travis's brother, immediately started the drive from Phoenix to Snowflake, the town Travis and Mike Rogers lived in. He arrives by morning of the 6th of November. The search that morning consisted of about 50 men spread out over the area. By the end of the day, nothing was found. On Friday, nothing was found either. It's not looking good. By Sunday, police have added helicopters, about 6 men on horseback, and planes buzzing overhead. Word has made it way out of the community about the UFO abduction. Ufologists have begun to arrive. By Sunday, the 9th of November, police have searched for 4 days and put up a $10,000 reward. It's at this time the cops start to suspect that one or all of the young men killed Travis, and this UFO story is some kind of a cover-up. The best way to find that out, at least in 1975, was to get the crew to take a, quote, lie detector test, unquote. Now, even back in 1975, the usefulness of these tests were already under question, but still routinely used by law enforcement. The crew was willing to do whatever they needed to in order to get their friend back. So on Monday the 10th, the men all go to the nearby town of Hallbrook to meet with examiner Cy Gilson from the Arizona Department of Public Safety in Phoenix.
I'm going to put some of my own little points in there. First of all, polygraph tests, no good comes from them. Let's just put it that way. Like, they can't be used against you in court. They can't be used to help you in court. If you refuse to take one, you become suspicious. If you take one and it picks up deceit or inconclusive, it doesn't help you at all. Mm-hmm. It makes you look worse. So if you're ever in an instance where they're requiring a polygraph test, just get a lawyer.
A lawyer
will get you out of it. You'll be fine. Because there's nothing good that comes from them. I'm big into true crime. So it's one of those things that every time I hear about polygraph tests, it's like, well, as soon as the suspect declines to take one, all of a sudden everybody's suspicious. But honestly, that's the right thing to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Because absolutely no good comes from it. Because they're so fallible, like I said, they can't be used in court. So there's no point in taking one.
Yeah.
And I remember in my psychology classes, one of my psychology classes, they taught us how to beat a polygraph test. Because it's so easy to beat them. Because they start out by asking you like the baseline questions to kind of get a baseline of your body fluctuations. Because that's all it's reading. It's your blood pressure and breaths and on temperature and all that stuff. And in the class, they taught us to, when you're asking those base questions, bite the inside of your lip, bite your tongue, do something to increase your blood pressure or your heart rate so that those read off. So that when you lie, it doesn't show any change. It shows what it was
in
your baseline.
And that'll be today's episode of
How to Get Away with Murder.
Gets Away with Murder.
But, yeah, I mean, so I don't put any faith in polygraphs. But the results of the polygraph tests are quite interesting.
So I won't go through the entire transcript of each person that took the test. But the test went on for some time with each of them being asked the exact same 4 questions over and over again until an indeterminate amount of time had passed. Question 1. Did you cause Travis Walton any serious physical injury last Wednesday afternoon? Question 2. Do you know if Travis Walton was physically injured by some other member of your work crew last Wednesday? Question number 3. Do you know if Travis Walton's body is buried or hidden somewhere in that Turkey Springs area? Question 4. Did you tell the truth about actually seeing a UFO last Wednesday when Travis Walton disappeared? Alan Dallas, the young man Travis described as having an uncontrollable anger and who had come close to fistfights with most people on the logging crew, walked out of his test midway. The reasons aren't clear, but it hinges on that he got angry because of the examiner's suspicious attitude. His test was determined inconclusive. As for the other 5 men, they passed. According to Cy Gilson, they believed they were telling the truth. Then that very night, just after 12 a.m., something very interesting happened.
Ring, ring.
In the book Fire in the Sky by Travis Walton, he describes that he was left on the side of the road after a few hours of being on the craft. Here is the excerpt in Travis's own words. Consciousness returned to me on the night. I awoke to found myself on the cold pavement west of Heber, Arizona. I was lying on my stomach, my head on my right forearm. Cold air brought me instantly awake. I looked up in time to see a light turn off on the bottom of a curved, gleaming hole. As I raised my head, a white light caught my eye just before it blinked off. Either a light had been turned off or a hatch had closed, cutting off the light from inside. I only caught a glimpse as I raised my head. I could not be sure which it was. Then I saw the mirrored outline of a rounded silvery disc hovering 4 feet above the paved surface of the road. It must have been about 40 feet in diameter because it extended several feet off the left side of the road. It was too large for the highway, and it extended past the roadside to my left to clear a cutaway rock embankment on the other side of the highway. It appeared to be about 14 feet high in the center. Now, that sounds like a different, like, ship than the one before.
Kind of, but then I was sitting there thinking, when things are in the sky especially, it's really hard to judge how high they are. So it very well could have been, because it's bigger than the other one, but it could have been the other one was just higher, and they couldn't tell how high it really was.
Oh, yeah.
So if it's lower to the road, then it would make it appear bigger because you're closer to it.
True.
Like, I'm thinking of like a stoplight. If you ever see a stoplight, they don't look that gigantic, but when you see a person working on the stoplight right next to it, those things are massive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I think it's a distance of, like, a difference of perception.
Yeah, that's a good point. For an instant, it floated silently above the road, a dozen yards away. I could see the night sky, the surrounding trees, and the highway center line reflected in the curving mirror of its hull. I noticed a faint warmth radiating onto my face. Then abruptly, it shot vertically into the sky, creating a strong breeze that stirred the nearby pine boughs and rustled the dry oak leaves that lay in the dry grass beside the road. It gave off no light, and it was almost instantly lost from sight. The most striking thing about its departure was its quietness. It seemed impossible that something so large, moving through the atmosphere at such speed, would not have shrieked through the air or even broke the sound barrier with a sonic boom. Yet it had been totally silent. I scrambled shakily to my feet. My legs felt rubbery. I swayed, then caught my balance. I looked around and recognized the deserted stretch of curving road as the highway that wound down the canyon into Heber from the west. I ran wildly down the deserted highway, across the bridge into Heber, stopping at the new building across from the Union 76 service station. No one answered my desperate knocking. No cars passed by. I ran down the highway over the second bridge to the row of telephone booths at the Exxon station. I dialed the operator. A dime was not required to reach an operator in our part of the country, and painted out the number of my sister, She was the only nearby relative with a telephone. My brother-in-law Grant answered. It was 12:05 a.m. I was in an incredible mental state. Difficult to describe. As best I can remember, I shouted something like, "They brought me back!" Then I babbled, "I'm out here in Heber. Please get somebody to come and get me." My hand shook as I held the cold receiver. Grant was not amused. He took this call to be another cruel joke.
I think you have the wrong number,
he replied sarcastically, starting to hang up. Wait, it's me, Travis, I screamed hysterically into the receiver.
Where are you?
He asked, still suspicious of a joke. I'm at the Heber Exxon station.
Okay,
he replied almost apologetically, yet still cautious of a prank.
Stay right there. I'll come and get you. Just hang on.
Grant drove the 3 miles from Taylor over to Snowflake and found my brother Dwayne at Mom's house. He told Dwayne about the call and of his doubts it was really me. Dwayne, too, thought the call might have been yet another example of someone's idiotic concept of humor. But they decided they couldn't risk not investigating. They set out for Heber, 33 miles away. Light suddenly shone onto the telephone booth. Relief flooded over me as I raised my head and saw the headlights of Dwayne's pickup. Dwayne and Grant got out and came to where I was still slumped in the phone booth. Dwayne opened the glass door of the booth and helped me to my feet.
Am I ever glad to see you?
Grant said. Dwayne helped me into the warm truck and asked Grant to drive. On the way to Snowflake, I tried to tell them about what happened to me, but I couldn't get it all out. They were awful. White skin, great big eyes, I sobbed in horror.
Take it easy, Travis. You're all right now. They didn't harm you, did they?
No, but those eyes, those horrible eyes, they just kept looking at me.
Just so you're okay, that's all that counts,
Dwayne said.
Everyone has been word sick about you.
If it's already after midnight, I must have been unconscious for a couple of hours, I replied shakily, because I only remember about an hour or an hour and a half inside that thing. Dwayne and Grant looked at me strangely.
Travis, feel your face,
Dwayne said. Good hell, I just shaved this morning and it feels like a week's growth, I exclaimed, still not comprehending.
Travis,
Dwayne said gently,
you've been missing for 5 days.
We will return to the book Fire in the Sky by Travis Walton one more time later on.
I think Dave needs to get paid to do some book reading for Audible.
Yeah. Well, we've now veered off the book.
Yeah.
That whole event is not how it happened in the movie.
Yeah.
So, we've now veered from the book. And if there's anything that I'm good at, it's pointing out the differences between books and movies. Dave hates to watch movies with me that I watched read the books.
Watch the books?
Yeah, I watch the books. No. When I read the books and then we watch the movie, he doesn't like doing that.
That's not right. That's not how it happened. That's not right.
I'll pause and be like, well, in the book, this kind of happened, but this is...
But those people weren't part of it. These people did it. And
I was really bad about True Blood because I was reading the books as the seasons were coming out.
Yeah.
So I'd be like, he died in the book. Why is he there?
Well, I mean, we have a whole new character that wasn't in the movie.
Yeah.
And Grant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't in the movie at all.
Well, the phone call went to Mike in the movie.
Yeah.
Now, if I also remember correctly, there were only 6 on the logging crew in the movie.
Yeah.
There wasn't 7.
Yeah. Well, and then also... when they found him, he was naked.
Yeah, it was raining.
It was raining. And then they called in like the ufologist guy to talk to him before they took him back, which really didn't make sense to me in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that was one part of the movie where I was like, why would you call that guy? Why would you just take him home? Then you might, if you want the help, maybe call that guy. But why would you sit there waiting for him? Well, the guy's naked in the rain. Take him home, then call the ufologist guy. I don't know. It was a weird yeah. sequence in the movie that it kind of made me go, huh? So I'm glad that didn't happen in real life. I would have really lost a lot of faith in his friends and family at that point. Like,
right.
My first concern would be for him.
Yeah.
Then we start worrying about the ufologists and all the people in the town.
Mm-hmm. Quit using that. Sense, Amy.
I know, logic. Who knew?
Once they get Travis to his mother's house, Duane checks him for injuries. The only thing they see is a red dot on the inside of Travis's right elbow, but Travis can't remember how it got there. Psychologically, Travis was most likely suffering from what is known nowadays as post-traumatic stress disorder. It's unclear whose idea this was, but they hid the fact Travis was back for now. Due to his mental state and how the police, reporters, and ufologists have all been wanting to talk to Travis, Duane helped Travis to his car and drove him to Phoenix in the middle of the night. He wanted to get Travis to the doctor to be examined far away from this town. The police were notified by the operator that someone had called Travis's sister close to midnight from a payphone. Sheriff Gillespie sent deputies to dust for prints at the three payphones. But from the prints they collected, none of them belonged to Travis. Around dawn on Tuesday, the 11th of November, Duane calls Sheriff Gillespie to report Travis's back. He doesn't divulge where they are. Instead, he says Travis is in a hospital in Tucson. Duane has decided that a regular medical doctor isn't going to be able to help his brother. So he gets in touch with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, or APRO. They send doctors to Duane's house in Phoenix to meet with Travis later that afternoon.
See, that makes a lot more sense to me. They get him to a doctor. They get him to a home that's warm. Get him, you know, probably showered and cleaned up.
Clothed.
And then they call in the ufologists. See, that would be the way my brain would work. Bravo to Duane.
The doctors uncovered some strange things. Travis was physically fine, and he didn't show any signs of starvation. If he hadn't eaten the time he was gone, there would have been evidence of this. I don't know anything about the test they performed other than they tested the urine to determine the result. Also during this urine test, they determined that Travis Walton had no alcohol or drugs in his system.
That's actually really good to know, because that was one of my theories.
Sheriff Gillespie arrived at Duane's house. Travis tries to tell him what happened while he was gone, but when he gets to describing the creatures, he has a meltdown. Travis agrees to take a lie detector test, but only under the conditions. It has to be private, no press, no media circus. Gillespie agrees to those terms. They would back out of the deal later once they found out that a, quote, lie detector test, unquote, only tests stress levels. Duane made the connection quickly that in Travis's mental state, talking about the incident would cause Travis extreme stress, and the results of the test would show, quote, unquote, deception. If it wasn't for APRO and the sensational newspaper, the National Enquirer, the following things might not have happened. They offered Travis and Duane to stay in a hotel room to escape the phone ringing off the hook back home. They also agreed to pay for scientific testing that APRO thought should be done. The only condition was the Enquirer got an exclusive.
That's also something there, too. Something else that happened in the movie that I thought was stupid on the part of the family and friends was as soon as he gets back, they have this big party for him.
A big party.
With all these people. And I'm sitting there thinking, from the movie, the Travis character in the movie, you can tell is obviously like distressed. Mm-hmm. And why would you have like a... I mean, I understand everybody's excited that he's back and all that.
You can let him warm up to everything.
Give the guy a chance. And in the movie, that's when he has his breakdown. It's not, you know, while talking about it. But Yeah, and then the next scene after that is pretty darn intense in the movie.
Yeah.
But that is something that I do feel like his family had his best interest like in mind. Whereas in the movie I didn't feel that.
Yeah.
Like at all. Yeah. So I am glad to know that they actually were taking care of him and not throwing him to the wolves per se.
Oh yeah, me too. On November 13th, Dwayne and Travis check into the Scottsdale Sheraton. Reporters from the Inquirer, investigators from APRO, and a UFO expert are all in the area. At this point, Travis hasn't been able to piece together the words to describe the things he has encountered. That's when they bring in a hypnotist. I'm going to break the timeline real quick because I think it's important to have information from all sides. Hypnotic regression therapy is a highly criticized practice, but it might not have been utilized in this case. There has been some frequently asked questions for Travis Walton over the years, such as, did the aliens communicate with you? To which he answered no. Despite my barrage of questions, they made no vocalizations, nor was I aware of any telepathic communications during my entire experience. Another question he gets asked often is, did you recall your experience only under regressive hypnosis? To which he answers, no. I did not recall any experiences under hypnosis that I could not remember before. The hypnosis did help me verbalize my experience in greater detail without being overwhelmed by anxiety, but did not help me regain any lost memories.
If we go back to the Betty and Barney Hill episode, I think we said that there were no alien abductions that hadn't been remembered without regression. So that's interesting that his was.
Because I'd always heard it was, because it always seems that the only people that claim Travis Walton went through hypnotic regression therapy are the skeptics, which, as you would imagine, are numerous. We will hear about one of the most motivated skeptics later. But first, let's return back to Fire in the Sky by Travis Walton to hear what he wrote about his memories of the experience. I moaned silently. My first glimmer of slowly returning consciousness brought with it the single overpowering sensation of pain. Oh, damn! I gritted my teeth against the agony. The excruciating ache almost caused me to lose consciousness again. I felt badly burned, all over, even inside me. Giggity. I was lying on my back. I didn't try to move or even to open my eyes at first. I was weak, so watery weak, that I knew if I attempted to move even my arm, I'd lapse back into unconsciousness. A bitter, metallic taste covered my tongue. My mouth was dry and I was very thirsty. Oddly, the weakness in my muscles did not seem to come from hunger. The trembling felt odd, like a strange mixture of exertion and illness. Something was terribly wrong. I sluggishly dragged my eyelids open. I could not see anything. Then a blurred image began to coalesce. My eyes struggled against the agony. My sight shifted in and out of focus. My vision slowly became clear. The hazy scintillations of light gradually solidified into an image. I could make out some kind of light source above me. The fixture was a luminous rectangle about 3 feet by 1.5 feet. The diffused light came from the flat, frosted surface of the rectangle. For an instant, I could distinguish the brushed metal luster of a ceiling and the softer, reflected glow above the light. The fixture seemed to be suspended lower and closer to me than the ceiling. I deduced from the nearness of the ceiling that the hard, flat surface I was laying on was a raised table of some kind. What's the matter with my eyes? I asked myself. The ceiling is all crooked. It's too small on this end and too large on that end. Were my eyes playing tricks on me? I closed them against the discomfort, but soon opened them again to ward off the feeling of vertigo that welled up in me. The odd shaped ceiling was indeed as I had perceived it, generally triangular, with the base towards my feet. What a weird place, I reflected wonderingly. I had been hurt. Yeah, that was it. But what? I could remember straightening up and feeling as though somebody had whacked me with a baseball bat. Suddenly, the memory of what happened before I'd blacked out came rushing back with stunning impact. I remembered staring in the clearing in the woods, looking up at the glowing saucer. Where the hell am I? Oh my God! The hospital? They brought me here to the hospital? I thought. It was very hot and humid. The heavy air was almost stifling. It smelled slightly stale and muggy. I was sweating. Warm moisture beaded my temples. Feeling my jacket bunched up under my arms, I wondered why a nurse had not removed it. I still had all my work clothes on, even my boots, and the jacket was just too warm. I must be injured so bad that there wasn't time to take off my coat, I thought. Maybe I was in an emergency room of some kind. Then I felt something pressing down lightly on my chest. It felt cool and smooth. I looked down and managed to hold my eyes open long enough to see that my shirt and jacket were pushed up around my shoulders, exposing my chest and abdomen. A strange device curved around my body. It was about 4 or 5 inches thick, and I could feel it extended from my armpits to a few inches above my belt. It curved down to the middle of each side of my rib cage. It appeared to be made of a shiny, dark gray metal or plastic. I looked past the upper edge of the device. I could see the blurry figures of the doctors leaning over me with their white masks and caps. They were wearing unusual orange-colored surgical gowns. I could not make out their faces clearly. Abruptly, my vision cleared. The sudden horror of what I saw rocked me as I realized that I was definitely not in a hospital. I was looking squarely into the face of a horrible creature. It looked steadily back at me with huge, luminous brown eyes the size of quarters. I looked frantically around me. There were three of them. I struck out at the two on my right, hitting one with the back of my arm, knocking it into the other one. My swing was more of a push than a blow, I was so weakened. The one I touched felt soft through the cloth of its garment. The muscles of its puny physique yielded with a sponginess that was more like fat than sinew. The creature was light and had fallen back easily. I lunged unsteadily to my feet and staggered back against a utensil-arrayed bench that followed the curve of one wall. I leaned there heavily, keeping my eyes riveted on those horrid entities. My action had caused the device across my chest to crash to the floor. No wires or tubes connected it to me, or to anything else. It rocked back and forth on its upper side. The rocking sent shifting beams of greenish light out onto the floor from the underside of the machine. My aching body would not do what I told it to. My legs felt too weak to hold me up. I leaned heavily on the counter. The monstrous trio of humanoids started towards me. Their hands reached out at me. With the superhuman effort of a cornered animal, I ground out the strength to defend myself. Fighting the splitting pain in my skull, I grabbed for something from the bench with which to fend them off. My hand seized on a thin, transparent cylinder about 18 inches long. It was too light to be an effective club. I needed something sharp. I tried to break the tip of the tube. I smashed the end of the glass-like one down on the waist-high metal slab I had been lying on. It would not break. I sprang into a fighting stance with my legs spread wide to brace for the attack. I lashed out with the weapon at the advancing creatures, screaming desperate, hysterical threats. The creatures slowed but continued toward me, their hands outstretched. "Keep back, damn you!" I shrieked menacingly. They halted. In a snarling crouch, I held the tube threateningly back behind my head. I felt hopelessly trapped. I was surrounded, with my back to the wall. They stood still, mutely. They were a little under 5 feet in height. They had a basic humanoid form, two legs, two arms, hands with five digits each, and a head with the normal human arrangement of features. But beyond the outline, any similarity to humans was terrifyingly absent. Their thin bones were covered with white, marshmallowy-looking flesh. They had a single-piece coverall-type suits made of soft, suede-like material, orangish-brown in color. I could not see any grain in the material, such as cloth has. In fact, their clothes did not appear even to have any seams. I saw no buttons, zippers, or snaps. They wore no belts. The loose, billowy garments were gathered at the wrist and perhaps the ankles. They didn't have any kind of raised collar at the neck. They wore simple pinkish-tan footwear. I could not make out the details of their shoes, but they had very small feet, about a size 4 by our measure. When they extended their hands towards me, I noticed they had no fingernails. Their hands were small, delicate, without hair. Their thin, round fingers looked soft and unwrinkled. Their smooth skin was so pale it looked chalky, like ivory. Their bald heads were disproportionately large for their puny bodies. They had bulging, oversized craniums, a small jaw structure, and an underdeveloped appearance to their features that was almost infantile. Their thin-lipped mouths were narrow. I never saw them open. Lying close to their heads on either side were tiny, crinkled lobes of ears. Their miniature rounded noses had small, oval nostrils. The only facial feature that didn't appear underdeveloped was those incredible eyes. Those glistening orbs had brown irises, twice the size of those of a normal human's eyes, nearly an inch in diameter. The iris was so large that even parts of the pupils were hidden by the lids, giving the eyes a certain cat-like appearance. There was very little of the white part of the eye showing. They had no lashes and no eyebrows. With all the screaming and the hysterical questions I had thrown at them, they never once said anything to me. I did not hear them speak to each other. Their mouths never made any kind of sound or motion. The only sounds I heard were those of movements and my own voice. Just as I girded myself to spring at them, they abruptly turned and scurried from the room. They went out the open door, turned right, and disappeared. The anticlimax of their retreat was incredible. The extra adrenaline they had squirted into my bloodstream left me trembling uncontrollably. I collapsed back against the bench, struggling to slow my racing heart. I gulped the heavy air in ragged gasps. Afraid of the aliens' return, I looked toward the door. No sign of anyone. I needed something better to defend myself with. I noticed an array of strange instruments lying on the bench. The instruments were arranged near the middle of the bench, leaving either end of it clear. There was nothing I recognized, but some of the chrome-like objects reminded me of those in a laboratory or doctor's office. All of the objects were too small to be effective as weapons. I was more afraid of being hurt by some of those instruments. I touched nothing more, throwing the clear tube I still held down on the floor. "I've got to get out of here," I thought frantically with a surge of determination. There was a curving hallway about 3 feet wide outside the door. The ceiling of the hall gave off a faint, almost unnoticeable illumination. I looked to the right down the narrow, dimly lit passage in the direction the aliens had run. There was no one in sight. Seeing nothing in the passage to my left, I began walking that way. I broke into a frightened run down the narrow corridor. The cramped hallway turned continuously in a tight curve to the right. I dashed past an open door on my left without looking in. only 10 feet down the hall from the door I had just exited. I caught a glimpse of a room, but was afraid to stop. Wait just a damn minute, Travis. I struggled to get a grip on my self-control. What if I missed a chance at that doorway to find a way out of this place? I saw another doorway 10 more feet ahead on my right. I slowed down to a walk as I neared it. Maybe this would be my way out. The door was only a few feet ahead on my right, and the inside curve of the hallway. I slowed down, turned, and stopped in the opening. I looked in cautiously. I saw a round room about 16 feet across, with a domed ceiling about 10 feet high. Equally spaced around the room were 3 rectangular outlines resembling closed doorways. No one there. The room was totally empty except for a single chair that faced away from me. I looked behind me. The hallway was still empty. I slowly entered the room. I hesitated to approach the high back chair. There might be somebody sitting in it that I could not see from behind. I circled, keeping my distance from the chair, checking to see if anyone was sitting in it. I followed the curve of the wall to get around to where I could see. I was ready to beat an instant retreat if I should see one of those hideous creatures again. I stopped every few steps to crane my neck over the back of the chair. Seeing nobody, I continued around to where I could ascertain with much relief that the chair was unoccupied. Glancing apprehensively toward the open door, I slowly went toward the chair. As I gradually approached it, a very curious thing began to happen. The closer I got to it, the darker the room became. Small points of light became visible on or through the walls, even the floor. I stepped back, and the effect diminished. I stepped forward, and it increased again, the points of light becoming brighter in contrast to the darkening background. It was like the stars coming into view in the evening, only very much faster. The matte gray of the metal wall just faded out to be replaced by the beginning speckled deep black of space. I looked at the controls on the chair. On the left arm, there was a single short, thick lever and an oddly shaped molded handle atop some dark brown material. On the right arm, there was an illuminated lime green screen about 5 inches square with a lot of black lines on it that intersected each other at all angles. Under that, a square of approximately 25 colored buttons arranged in about 5 vertical rows with 1 color for each row. I looked for symbols or written words and found none. The experiment I was considering was risky, but I was desperate. Maybe one of those buttons would open a door or something. On impulse, I went ahead and pushed one of the green buttons. I looked around the room and listened carefully. Nothing happened. When I pushed the button, I noticed that the lines on the screen had moved. I recklessly pushed another green one. The lines rapidly changed angles, sliding down each other, then stopped. I pushed some of the other colored buttons. Nothing happened. Nothing moved, and no sound could be heard. Trembling, I sat down on the hard surface of the chair. I put my hand into the molded T-grip of the lever. The handle was slightly small for my hand. The whole chair seemed a little too small. I rotated the handle of the lever forward, feeling the slow, fluid resistance of it. I felt suddenly disoriented as the stars began moving downward in front of me in unison. Quickly, I pulled my hand off the lever, which returned to its original vertical position. The stars stopped moving, but remained where they were when I released the lever. It sounds like he's like in the captain's chair.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's bigger than he is, because these creatures are so small. Let's read some more. If this thing is flying, I could crash it or throw it off course and get lost or something. I resolved not to tamper with those controls anymore. I might escalate a desperate situation into a fatal disaster. I got out of the chair and walked to the edge of the room. As I did, the stars faded out and the surfaces of the wall Ceiling and floor came into sight. I moved over to one of the rectangles resembling closed doors. I searched the edges for a sign of a switch or an opening mechanism. Seeing none, I put my eye to the crack. I could not see any light. I looked around for some kind of symbol or writing that would help me figure out where I was or how to get out of there. None. I walked back to the chair and stood beside it. Looking at the buttons, I was thinking about pushing some of them when I heard a faint sound. I whirled around and looked at the door. There, standing in the open doorway, was a human being.
Dun, dun, dun!
I stood, frozen to the spot. He was a man about 6 feet 2 inches tall. His helmeted head barely cleared the doorway. He was extremely muscular and evenly proportioned. He appeared to weigh about 200 pounds. He wore a tight-fitting, bright blue suit of soft material like velour. His feet were covered with black boots, a black band or belt wrapped around his middle. He carried no tools or weapons on his belt or in his hands. No insignia marked his clothing. I ran up to him, exclaiming, babbling all sorts of questions. The man remained silent throughout my verbal barrage. I was worried by his silence. He took me firmly but gently by the arm and gestured for me to go with him. He led me out of that room and hurried me down the narrow hallway, pulling me along behind him due to its narrowness. He stopped in front of a closed doorway that slid open into the wall. I did not see what caused it to open. The door opened into a bare room so small it was more like a foyer or a section of hallway. The door slid shut quickly and silently behind us. Again, I attempted to talk to the man as we stood there. No answer. We spent approximately 2 minutes in the metal cubicle, no more than 7 by 5 by 12 feet. Then a doorway the same size as the other door and directly opposite slid open. The brilliant warm light that came through the opening door into the airlock room was almost like daylight in color and brightness. Fresh, cool air wafted in, reminding me of springtime in the out-of-doors, making me realize just how dark and stifling that place had been. What relief that fresh air was. The air moved around me in a softly fluctuating current. I stood and inhaled deeply the clean, cool breeze. The vast tinges of the ache in my head and chest almost completely disappeared. I had nearly forgotten the discomfort that had been with me constantly since I had regained consciousness. I descended a short, steep ramp 7 or 8 feet to the floor. I looked around to discover that, although I was outside that dim, humid craft, I was not out of doors. I was in a huge room. The ceiling was sectioned into alternating rectangles of dark metal, and those gave off light. The ceiling itself curved down to form one of the larger walls in the room. The room was shaped like one quarter of a cylinder laid on its side. The outside of the craft we had just left was shaped like the one we had seen in the woods, but was very much larger, about 65 feet in diameter and 16 feet high. It did not emit light. Instead, it had a surface of shiny brushed metal luster. It seemed to radiate a faint heat from its hull. The craft either sat flat on its bottom, or if it had legs, they were only a few inches high. It sat nearly in the middle of the large room. On my left, toward one end of the large room, there were 2 or 3 oval-shaped saucers, reflecting light like highly polished chrome. I could see 2 of them very clearly, and a silvery reflection that could have been another shiny, rounded craft. They were about 40 or 45 feet in diameter, quite a bit smaller than the angular vehicle I had just come out of. I saw no projections or breaks in the smooth, shiny, flattened spheres. They sat on very rounded bottoms, and I could not see how they balanced that way. The man escorted me across the open floor to a door that opened silently and quickly from the middle outward. We were in a hallway about 6 feet wide, illuminated from the 8-foot-high ceiling, which was one long panel of softly diffused light. The hallway was straight and perhaps 80 feet long. Closed double doors were distributed along the corridor. At the end of the hallway, another pair of double doors. I watched closely this time. I did not see him touch anything, but again the doors slid silently back from the middle. We entered a white room approximately 15 feet square with another 8-foot-high ceiling. The room had a table and a chair in it. But my interest was immediately focused on the three other humans. Two men and a woman were standing around the table. They were all wearing velvety blue uniforms like the first man's, except they had on no helmets. The two men had the same muscularity and the same masculine good looks as the first man. The woman also had a face and figure that was the epitome of her gender. They were smooth-skinned and blemishless. No moles, freckles, wrinkles, or scars marked their skin. The striking good looks of the man I had first met became more obvious on seeing them all together. They shared a family-like resemblance, although they were not identical. "Would somebody please tell me where I am?" I implored. I was still utterly shaken from my encounter with those awful creatures. "What the hell is going on? What is this place?" They didn't answer me. They only looked at me, though not unkindly. One man and the woman came around the table, approaching me. Silently, they each took me by an arm and led me toward the table. I didn't know why I should cooperate with them. They wouldn't even tell me anything. But I was in no position to argue, so I went along at first. They lifted me easily onto the edge of the table. I became wary and started protesting. "Wait a minute, just tell me what you're going to do." I began to resist them, but all three began pushing me gently backward down onto the table. I looked up at the ceiling, covered with panels of softly glowing white light with a faint blue cast. I saw that the woman suddenly had an object in her hand from out of nowhere. It looked like one of those clear, soft, plastic oxygen masks, only there were no tubes connected to it. The only thing attached to it was a small black golf ball-sized sphere. She pressed the mask down over my mouth and nose. I started to reach up to pull it away. Before I could complete the motion, I rapidly became weak. Everything started turning gray. Then there was nothing at all but black oblivion.
I have totally solved this. First of all, Pleiadiacs unite. And, yeah, well, those are Pleiadiacs. Or those are Pleiadians. Those are our Nords.
Nordics, you mean?
Yeah, Nordics, there we go. I'm thinking Skyrim. Those are our Nordics.
Controlling the Greys.
Controlling the Greys. The Greys are like, they're little, probably slaves. Should I get into my theory now, or should I wait until the end?
That's up to you.
I have a good theory. I'll wait till the end.
Okay.
But, yeah. That would have been way better than the scene in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So that is so much cooler.
Yeah.
The movie...
The movie scenes were cool.
The movie scene was cool, and it was super intense. It was like thriller scene, especially when that needle's coming down towards his eyeball.
Ugh.
But that was way cooler. Mm-hmm. I want to see that version.
Oh, yeah. I liked how... I think it was really cool. He saw all kinds of different spaceships and things.
Yeah. He was like on the mothership, and then there were other ships in the
which kind of makes sense. Like, he's like in the captain's chair, like moving shit around, and then all of a sudden one of these guys is like, oh, and then goes and gets in the craft.
Oh fuck.
you're about to cause crash. But he didn't say anything.
Man,
I wonder why he had a helmet on and the others didn't, though.
In case he got punched in the face.
Maybe.
I mean, he's already, like, got weapons.
Or maybe it's just standard operating procedure before you get into a vehicle to put a helmet on. I know when I was in the Army, it was.
Could be that. I mean, it could be a couple different things. It could, like I said, it could be protection because he didn't know what he's going into. The last they knew, the guy had a weapon.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it could have just been.
And maybe the Nords are allergic to whatever the Greys have in their spaceships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
That muggy air.
Yeah.
That's in there.
That would have been so much cooler. Like, as you're reading it, I'm like 5 or 6 paragraphs ahead of you. And like, I finish reading it before you get there. So I'm like, oh, this is so cool. I'm so interested in this. Oh. So I want somebody to remake the movie, but with that scene.
Yeah.
All right. Continue, Dave.
The hypnosis helped to calm Travis's anxiety and post-traumatic stress down enough to where he got the story out. On Friday, the 14th of November, Travis is rescheduled to take a, quote, lie detector test, unquote. Sheriff Gillespie had promised it would be private, and no reporters would know until after it was finished. As Travis was getting ready to leave, a reporter called his house to ask for a comment about the test he was taking later that day. Travis slammed the phone down and called Sheriff Gillespie and told him he's not coming to take his test. Dwayne and Travis go back to the Sheridan to meet with psychiatrists that were brought in to help Travis cope through this. The Inquirer wants to give Travis their own lie detector test, but as the psychiatrists have already pointed out, the stress will cause Travis to fail regardless of the truth. So a deal is worked out where if Travis doesn't pass, they won't publish the results. Travis takes the test and he fails it. It says he showed signs of quote-unquote deception, which only means he showed signs of stress, which the body can create from being deceptive, but the body can also create stress from many other thought patterns, memories, phobias, anxieties, fears, situations, and so on. The Inquirer, true to their word, published Travis's story on December 16th of 1975, using the story he told. The police go on about their business. Travis, Dwayne, Grant, Mary, Mike, Ken, John, Steve, Alan, and Dwayne Smith all go on with their daily lives. Travis, Dwayne, and Mary take a polygraph test in February of 1976, and they all pass. Life was returning to normal for everyone involved. Until a famous UFO skeptic named Philip J. Klass starts to dig into the case. At this point in history, Philip Klass was an adamant debunker of UFO encounters. You could say one of the most motivated skeptics of the time. Klass finds an interview Mike Rogers did with a UFO investigator way back during the search for Travis. In the interview, Mike voices some worry that they are behind on their logging contract, and he hopes the U.S. Forest Service will forgive the lateness due to Travis's disappearance. Klass argued that the UFO story was a hoax Travis and Mike had carried out to avoid being docked 10% of their fee from the late contract. Not only that, but the NBC network had ran a movie about an alien abduction only 2 weeks before Travis went missing about Betty and Barney Hill. Klass also put forward the very night that movie aired, Mike Rogers wrote the Forest Service trying to get an extension on the contract. Then Klass brought out Travis's failed polygraph results for the Inquirer. Then, in a strange move, Klass attacks the credibility of the polygraph tests that were passed by everyone else, including the one Travis passed in February of 76. He brings forward that Travis was a known drug user, intravenous drug user is what he points out. And that's just the highlights, really. It was 17 pages of accusations altogether. He sends this report to every UFO organization and every skeptical publication. Travis and Mike go back and forth with class about retaking a polygraph. Class refuses. In July of 1976, right after class published his accusations and findings, the Inquirer awarded Travis and his crew $5,000 for the, quote, best UFO story of the year, unquote. In 1978, Travis wrote his book, the one we've been reading excerpts from, titled Fire in the Sky. In 1993, the motion picture Fire in the Sky came out. On TravisWalton.com, under the frequently asked questions, it asks, why is the movie different from real events? To which Travis Walton answers, from the standpoint of those in the movie industry, factors they consider important in telling a story through the medium of movies, as opposed to the printed page, involves an entirely different set of priorities. The right to affect those changes always lies with the producers, even in the case of very big-name novelists. Therefore, these changes were their call, and not within my power to approve or disapprove. Which I'm sure Stephen King can vouch for that as well.
I mean, Stephen King doesn't like The Shining. He does not like the way that they took that movie.
Now, this film, when I saw it for the first time, I was only like 11 or 12.
I was 30.
Let me see. I was 36.
It came out in 93. I was born in 83. So yeah, about 11 or 12. It scared me so freaking bad.
Yeah. I was not scared at all during the movie, except for when that needle was coming down to the eyeball. same reason I can't wear contacts, because I can't get my finger in my eyeball to work together. Like, I see my finger coming towards my eyeball, my eyeball shoots away.
It is an intrusive thought I have, that scene of the needle going towards his eye.
Yeah.
That'll just pop in my head randomly, like, almost every day.
Yeah. I can't even do eye drops. Like, so anything that has to do with the eyes, that, But yeah. Yeah, the thought of LASIK surgery, like, that's enough for me. Like, I'll just wear glasses my entire life. Nah, I'm not doing that. The movie was really good. And I mean, it's fresh in my mind right now because I literally just watched it 2 days ago. But I'm a really bad person when it comes to comparing books to movies, like I said earlier. I think I would much rather have seen the novel version of at least some of those scenes. I understand why they did it the way they did it.
The alien abduction scene, like the aircraft scene and everything, so different. It makes it scarier. And
yeah, and also, and
X-Files was around at the time. Didn't it come out in like 92 or 93?
It was around in that era. I don't know exactly when it came out.
Or was
out,
it though. Even later? But it was super scary like that, too.
Yeah, I think it was the ad. I mean, as us who know a little bit about aliens and stuff, the real story seems more interesting and cooler. But as a movie buff, what they did, I think, was the right call.
It definitely is going to attract more people because it becomes a thriller at that point.
Yeah.
Now, most of the movie is literally just the hunt for Travis.
Yeah.
Like, that's the first, 75% of the movie is just look what happened to Travis, where Travis go, where is Travis? And then it focuses a lot on the life of
Mike
and then the people around that were around looking for him. Mm-hmm. And there's a character in the movie that doesn't exist in real life that Chad and I were both really excited to see. He was in the movie, and that's James Garner. James Garner is a Normanite. He grew up in our town. Mike went to school like three blocks from where we work.
Yeah.
Like,
I was all excited, and honestly, he was probably the worst character in the entire movie.
It's like his character felt completely out of place.
Yeah.
It was like that character didn't fit into the story. And I told Chad, I said, it's almost like they just took Maverick and put him in this movie. Like, he felt like it was the same character. It was just like,
it was a great performance. It was just it didn't fit in the movie.
But the movie is still really good. Like, it's one of those things, like, with all the things that I can nitpick about the movie, still a really good movie, especially for the time.
I mean, quality wise too. I mean, you look at it being in 93. I mean,
it wasn't really CGI or a whole lot of CGI or anything, but it all looked really pretty good. Like, I mean, even the aliens were kind of creepy looking and really unique, I thought.
I was super excited in the movie where the suits were like space suits, which has kind of been my theory forever when it comes to Greys.
Yeah, the Grey was just a big space suit with big eyes.
Yeah, like visors. Like, so I thought, I was like, hey, that's mine. And I hadn't seen the movie until I was 36. So, but yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen it, I recommend seeing it. It is definitely a bromance.
Yeah.
Between Travis and Mike.
Oh, they were extremely close.
Yeah. And in the end, I felt so bad for Mike. Travis came in the movie. Travis came out of it relatively unharmed. But poor Mike.
His family has kids. Mike gets a divorce.
But spoiler alert, but the movie came out in the 90s.
Yeah, like, I'm not caring about spoiler alerts or 20-year-old movie.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, go check it out on Amazon Prime.
It is on Prime right now, and it's also on something else, but yeah, it's free on Prime, so definitely worth a watch. There's also a documentary on there about Travis Walton. I haven't watched it yet, though, but I definitely want to get this book and read this book, because I'm liking his story a lot better than the movies.
Well, Dave just read half of it.
I'm going to get the book, and I'm going to have you read it to me.
Okay. That sounds good.
But no, I liked it a lot. That was a good movie. And the story is really fascinating to me. I've always heard about Travis Walton, and I've heard other podcasts do stuff on Travis Walton, but I guess it never really sunk in as deeply as it has now, to where this is a really interesting case.
So on March 12th, 1993, the opening day for Fire in the Sky, Travis Walton, Mike Rogers, and Philip Klass all appeared on Larry King Live at the same time. Not even 5 minutes into this segment, a shouting match had broken out. Klass brought evidence against their story in the form of how calm Travis's mother was when they informed her son was missing. Mike Rogers accused Klass of being a disinformation specialist from Washington, D.C. that engages in character assassination and mudslinging. Klass then screams at Mike Rogers, calling him a goddamn liar.
I want to watch this.
You can find it on YouTube.
I'm going to have to go look it up.
Klass goes on to say that he has hard evidence and states during the interview on the 8th of November in 1975 with UFO investigator Fred Sylvanus, neither Mike Rogers or Travis's brother Dwayne say they are worried about Travis. The evidence doesn't get much harder than that. Rumors and conspiracies have been around for years that the government has actively suppressed UFO sightings and abductions, and that certain skeptics have been paid by the government. These agents do various things like present alternate explanations, engage in character assassination, and basically just poke holes in the stories. There is also agents which feed these types of stories to keep public attention away from programs like nuclear testing, spy plane development, and so on. We've covered a lot of this stuff. Now, Philip J. Klass could have been one of these agents. Klass did offer Steve Pierce, one of the witnesses and the youngest member of the logging crew, $10,000 to come out and say it was a hoax. There's a peculiar thing most people do when a skeptic comes forward and makes a bold claim or confession. People offer them belief based off of no evidence other than testimony. I'll give an example. Let's say someone comes forward and says, I was the one in the suit in that famous Bigfoot film. The narrative goes straight to it was all a hoax. No one really questions it. Even the truest of believers don't set out to disprove their claims, assassinate their character, mudsling, or try to bribe the people around them. When you step back and take a look at the intentions of those involved, you can see where the motivation lies. Another one of Klass's claims was that Travis Walton was a UFO enthusiast. If Travis was, and I believe he was, in the 1970s, He would have known that going public with something as bizarre as this would not have resulted in wealth and fame, but ridicule and mockery. This is almost the first lesson you learn when you read about the life of someone who has come forward regarding UFO phenomena. And taking into account what we just talked about, how both skeptics and believers alike view a false confession and how they react to it, it sort of in a weird way gives someone who has truly experienced something a way out of a lifetime of ridicule and mockery without needing to prove anything. Why didn't Travis Walton ever take that way out, even after all these years? Steve Pierce refused the $10,000 offered by Philip Glass and went public about the offered bribe.
Good for him.
Now, Glass was a journalist. He was not a rich man. Without sounding too much like a crackpot, we could try to follow the money. This is all just theory, by the way. First off, let me tell you about Dr. Donald Menzel.
I remember that name.
Dr. Menzel was an astronomer at Harvard University and America's leading debunker of UFOs during the 1960s, something Glass got involved in the late 60s and throughout the next few decades. The name Dr. Donald Menzel may sound familiar to some of you. To jog your memory, he was involved in very high-level intelligence operations during and after World War II. A renowned cryptologist and security consultant to the CIA. He also just so happened to be one of the 13 men named on the Majestic 12 Eisenhower briefing document. Even though that document is questionable, I want to be completely transparent with this. Dr. Menzel was also very well connected to the National Security Agency. During the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the NSA was pretty much under the radar of the American people. I myself didn't even know this administration existed until after the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. Menzel and Glass had very close correspondence. Glass didn't have the types of connections and clearances. So maybe Dr. Menzel was employing or working out some kind of a deal with him. Glass, again, was a journalist, an aviation journalist, and he had his own connections to newspapers, magazines, radio, and television, at a time when the government didn't have a foothold in these forms of media, nor did they have much of a foothold on the goings-ons in other countries' aviation programs. In the 1970s, there was a major scandal with journalists passing information to CIA agents, sometimes quid pro quo. So I don't think it's a big leap in logic from there to say that the $10,000 was given to Glass to use in an attempt to discredit Travis Walton through Steve Pierce, to poke holes in this case. Especially when you consider this is a classic and well-known strategy used by intelligence operations. Where else could this $10,000 have came from?
Yeah, especially in the 70s. $10,000 in the 70s is a whole lot more than $10,000 is today.
Yeah.
$10,000 in the 70s could have bought you like 10 houses.
I totally would have just accepted it and then not done.
Now what you do is you accept it, you come out and you say it, and then you split it with Travis, and then you both are pretty much happy. You got
now it.
You also got to worry about the government coming back and getting you if you don't.
Now the National Enquirer did award them $5,000 for the best UFO story of the year. And that was very significant.
And you tack another $5,000 on top of that. Travis and Steve have got a pretty big bank. Heck, he could even split the $10,000 seven ways.
But you're forgetting about one thing. Integrity.
What's that?
When you're broke. Although they all just got to $5,000, right?
Yeah. So. Now this $10,000 could have came from because Glass was one of the leading skeptics at the time. Just money from other skeptics around the country putting into a pool to further his investigations, you know. But why was Glass so determined to kill this story? And why did he get so angry when he was accused of being a disinformation agent?
Mm-hmm.
He goes from 0 to 10 in that interview.
No, I'm not. Shit, I found out. I mean, no!
You know, Dr. Greer, who does a lot of UFO movie documentaries and research and all that, he is really big into the disinformation. Huh? And there's a whole documentary on Netflix where he shows what he calls proof of disinformation. You know, and exactly like you were saying, they will pump out stories that are fake to distract, while just debunking stories that are truthful, so nobody has a clue which way is up and down.
Yeah.
You know?
It's called muddy in the waters.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is definitely in the UFO community, this is something that is a common occurrence. And, yeah, I'm going to say straight up, I don't even need any more proof. Class was trying to do disinformation. I mean, anybody who's that adamant about debunking something,
they're getting something out of
They're getting something out of it. He's getting something out of it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he was all about the disinformation.
I mean, now in 2020, it's pretty common for people just to do that because they're offended.
Yeah.
But back in 75, through the 90s, they're getting something out of it to
go that hard into it. The fact that he was friends with Menzel, and Menzel has known ties to MJ-12.
And not just MJ-12, but the CIA, NSA.
Yeah.
I mean, that's known for a fact. The Eisenhower thing is, when we covered it, was kind of like, well, you know, it doesn't really show one way or the other, but it is interesting. Someone definitely did their homework on the investigation into it, but you never know.
I'm going to say Class was classless.
I think, in fact, he said that little red mark on his arm
was from him shooting up.
I think it was like he accused him of shooting up an LSD and angel dust combination.
That's not how those drugs work.
I could be
wrong.
Nothing
I know, but
I could be wrong on that because that sounds really off the wall.
A red dot is different than the track marks you usually get from intravenous drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Class wouldn't know.
Yeah, Class is doing it that way.
How about, why would the intelligence community want to debunk the Travis Walton case?
Because they don't want you to know about aliens.
Yeah.
Or they don't want you to know that Travis Walton was abducted by the Russians.
Well, either they don't want the truth to come out about aliens, or it's top secret government equipment that they don't want out.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Those would be the only two reasons I could think the government would want to muddy the waters in UFO sightings. Is either actually super top secret, equipment that we have that they don't want everybody knowing about, or it's actual aliens and they don't want everybody knowing about it.
Yeah.
Like, those are the only two logical reasons I can think of.
Now, my theory on that is the moment we stop being Americans, Russians, Britons, Koreans, and so on, and just become Earthlings, that'll be the day the governments of every nation will lose their power. The power they have fought, bribed, deceived, and frankly killed for. If you look at history, this played out on the microcosm with tribes and clans becoming enveloped or destroyed by city-states, city-states being enveloped or destroyed by nations, each leader or set of leaders losing their power as the macrocosm enveloped them.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we stop being...
So when we unite against a common enemy...
I mean,
the government has no control at that point.
I've quoted this many times, but Reagan states that in his address.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a very true statement. What happens when we have to quit being Americans and Russians and Chinese and we have to just be humans?
Yeah.
To fight a extraterrestrial enemy. And I feel like that's kind of how we are right now with COVID. And we're not doing a very good job.
We're only about 30% united.
So I'd hate to see aliens actually come to Earth.
I would love for them to. And then they can take the other 70%.
I don't know. I might want to go with them and just leave the other 70%.
It's like those memes. It's like, I'd come to abduct you. And it's like, oh, fuck, about time. Wait, what?
I mean.
Shotgun.
Exactly. Like,
I'm already packed. Let's go.
Let me get my lunchbox.
If it's like this, Kate, like Travis Walton's explanation of what happened, I'd be fine with going with him. I mean, that didn't seem like anything super horrible happened.
Yeah, he didn't get probed.
Nope. I've got my theory on what happened, but let's keep going.
On July 31st, 2008, Travis Walton appeared as a guest on the game show called The Moment of Truth. The premise of the show was to give contestants a polygraph test prior to recording and then divulge the results on air. As contestants provided their answers to the audience to win prizes, there is also a panel of the contestants' closest friends and family for added drama. Each time the contestant guessed correctly what the polygraph results determined, they won some money. But if they failed to guess correctly what the test determined, they would lose the game and face humiliation.
I watched this show when it was on.
Now, we have a clip of Travis on this show. After he answers 14 questions truthfully, some of the questions were, have you ever used drugs for recreational purpose?
Yes.
Have you ever been diagnosed with any mental disorders?
Yes. One psychiatrist, a skeptic, said Travis suffered from transitory psychosis and had delusions that this had occurred, which couldn't account for the sighting witnessed by others, witnesses of the crew.
Prior to your abduction, had you ever seen a UFO?
Yes.
Do you think most people in your hometown believe you were abducted by aliens?
No.
And in between these, they're talking with him and they're getting to know him and stuff. And he's talking about how the whole town was split. Even people were split along their marital lines where one partner would believe and one wouldn't. And it was real interesting. And then they start getting really personal. Do you sometimes feel as if your abduction experience ruined your life?
Yes.
Have you ever wished that any of your coworkers were abducted instead of you?
Yes.
And I believe Ken, I can't remember his last name. He was on this panel with him along with his wife and Travis's son and his daughter and one of his other friends. They brought Michael Shermer from Skeptic Magazine as a surprise guest to ask him one question. You know, just kind of for drama. Do you have any evidence to support your claim of being abducted?
There's piles of it, yes.
So he guesses all these right that, you know, the polygraph said that he wasn't being deceptive, that this was true, right? And then they ask him the question for the $100,000 prize. Play the clip.
On November 5th, 1975, well, Travis Walton has told us a detailed account. You can read his book. What is the title of the book?
Fire in the Sky.
Fire in the Sky. Also a movie based on his story, and basically he says he was driving with six crew members from a day of work where they saw flying saucer, and he jumped out of the truck, and the next thing was witnessed by Ken and others that a beam of energy or light hit you, and you believe that you were abducted, and Ken believes that you were abducted by aliens for that period of time. So we asked that question. Question 15 is simply this. Were you abducted by a UFO on November 5th, 1975?
That answer is... false.
Well, Travis, I told you at the very beginning of this show that I'm not a skeptic. And so I try not to judge or root one way or the other, but I was really hoping that this answer was a true answer. All I will say to you is that when asked this while strapped to the polygraph machine, it was deduced that your response was conclusively deceptive. Sadly, I'll say that the $100,000 you stood to win by answering truthfully is not yours, but I will happily say that by having the courage to face us and be here and answer these questions, 14 of which you answered truthfully, we have $25,000 for you. Is there?
Dun, dun, dun.
Polygraphs suck.
Yeah. That's why they're not admittable in court. But yeah, if he answered 14 truthfully, and some of those questions
were about abduction,
were about being him being abducted.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
Now,
it was a game show. It was all played out.
Well, that show ruined a lot of lives. I think it only aired for that one season because there were a lot of people who were not faithful, and there were a lot of people that did some illegal stuff at work.
Yeah.
And yeah, that show's just not the best show to go on.
You know what he did answer yes to on it, and it said it was true? They asked him if he had ever called in sick when he really just wanted the day off.
Yeah.
And he said no. And it said that was the truth.
He's a bigger man than I.
Even the host said that. He's like, I think I've even done it working for this show or whatever. But Travis, he made the following statement about his experience with this show. I normally would not have ever agreed to be on such a show. After my fellow crewmen and I passed polygraph tests from the Arizona State Police Polygraph Examiner, I wrote in my book that I was done addressing that aspect of it. There the matter rested until last year when I received the bad news from my employer of 11 years that over 100 of those most recently hired, which included me, would be permanently laid off. Coincidentally, I came home that day to receive a phone call from the Moment of Truth, inviting me to be a contestant with the possibility of winning up to $100,000. I'm no fool. I knew that the show's public lure was to familiarize the audience with the contestant's friends and family, and then shockingly disgrace him with a key failed question. I wrote to several friends about my misgivings. The examiner was their man, with a vested interest in giving his employer the scandalous Jerry Springer-type entertainment that has been the show's stock in trade. To say nothing of saving them from awarding any prize money. I was made even more uneasy to learn that, up to then, very few had won much of anything. The outrageous demand set down in their contract was the clincher. I declined their offer. But they persisted, modifying the standard contract to satisfy my objections. They said the rules were being changed to ensure more prizes would be awarded. My looming layoff pushed me to reconsider. I inquired as to whether good, accepted modern polygraph methods were being used. They assured me that was the case. I should have known better. But I figured all I had to do was tell the truth, even if I had to make public something embarrassing like a personal, business, or marital mistake, and I would win top prize. I didn't become aware of the shocking truth about the polygraph procedure they were using until it was too late. It did no good to tell them what I'd written in my book, page 322 years earlier, that, quote, "The American Polygraph Association Standards and Principles of Practice, item number 5 states,
a member shall not provide a conclusive decision or report based on the chart analyst without having collected at least 2 separate charts in which each relevant question is asked on each chart. A chart is one presentation of the question list.
There's many other violations of accepted procedure. We came back home and my wife had me retested with the most rigorous new test we could find. In New Mexico, where it is stringently regulated by the state because results are admissible in court there, a firm highly recommended by other examiners, one that does work for the Albuquerque Police Department, the New Mexico State Prison, and the U.S. Marshal's Office. The most accepted methods on state-of-the-art computerized equipment. I passed two different new tests flawlessly. Then I found a website that was even more devastating of any claim of legitimacy for the moment of truth. The truth about the moment of truth. Written by a court-certified polygraph expert back in 2004, shortly after the show debuted, he began with...
The polygraph aspect of this show is not validity whatsoever.
And?
This test format will not determine truth or deception.
In fact, I wrote years ago that the GAO tests show such methods would yield as high as 80% false positives. He wrote in conclusion,
due to the vague, subjective, futuristic nature and sheer volume of relative questions asked on the moment of truth, there can be little more than a chance accuracy in determining truth or deception to these questions. In other words, they could simply flip a coin and achieve the same accuracy level.
Saying you'll get the same opinion from any accredited polygraph school. I then proceeded to gather several more equally damning judgments from some of the very top experts in the world in polygraph. Plus, I had several international media forums lined up. So there's a bit of a letdown because I was geared up to defend myself in a way that would have unfortunately demolished the show and seriously hurt Fox. Too bad, because I think that the producers I dealt with are good, well-intentioned people who had been duped by a dishonest examiner.
Yep. Ready for my theory?
Agreed. Yep, go ahead.
I've been wanting to hear your theory all night.
Wrong.
All right.
Where cows?
So this craft is up in the sky. Now, I would like to see a geological survey of the area, because if we remember back to
Rendlesham Forest,
we noticed that there was, at those coordinates, there were quite a lot of limestone deposits in those areas. So I'd like to get a geographical map of that. But let's say the ship is there refueling. Because that was kind of what we had come up with, is maybe they get energy somehow from the limestone or some kind of sediment in the earth. They're refueling. It's sitting there hovering. They may not even know Travis is underneath it. Because he talks about how the things start moving and the ship starts rocking back and forth. The ship's full. It's getting ready to take off. Maybe part of its propulsion is like an electric shock. Like, it sends out the energy. It hits Travis. They're like, oh, shit. They see his buddies leave. They take him up because they're Nordics, and Nordics are good. They bring him onto the ship. He's talking about how dry and dehydrated he feels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I'm thinking that when you have the type of heat that comes from like an electric shock, it probably zaps a lot of the water out of the body.
That would also explain why he's hurting all over.
And that's why he's hurting all over, because anybody who's been struck by lightning or had electric shock, they talk about how their body just hurts.
Yeah, he described it as he felt like he was burned both inside and outside.
Okay, so they take him on the ship and they heal him. That's why it looks like a medical room, is they are actually trying to help him and save him. Once he gets up and starts moving around, they're like, okay, well, I guess we're done. They go ahead and scurry off. They send in the human likes because, of course, he's going to feel a little bit more at ease with somebody who looks like him, which is exactly what happened.
Which is incredibly racist.
Well, I mean, it is what happened. And then I think that they just knocked him back out just to keep him calm because he started getting agitated again.
Right.
But that's what I think happened. I think it was they accidentally got him and they were trying to heal him. Because it didn't sound to me like they were trying to probe him or do any kind of
weird experiments
on him.
It's like someone who accidentally gets hit by a car and they're like, oh shit. And it's like, hey guys, you want to get your friend? We'll pay for the medical. Where are you guys going? Guys? Well, fuck, now we have to deal with this. Damn it, you call the authorities, Jim. I'm not doing it. It's the third guy this week.
Now, they were saying that he hit his shoulder pretty hard when he landed, and he didn't have any bruising or anything like that. And so that goes well into your theory. Because I know that's one of Klaas's claims that he should have at least had some bruising on his shoulder after 5 days from being hit there, but I don't even know if that's true. I can't think of any bruise that's been on me longer than just a couple. Yeah.
All I can think of, I have bruises that pop up randomly that I don't know how long they've been there, so I couldn't tell you. But I just think that if aliens exist and they're able to fly spaceships across the galaxy, the universe, whatever it is, they're coming from other galaxies or they're just moving around in ours or... Or just our solar system. But they have that ability. I'm going to bet they have some pretty awesome medical technology as well.
I'm guessing whatever machine that was on him was probably healing his internal organs and stuff that probably shut down or something from the electric shock. And
Because
giving out a green light, so whatever that light is doing is probably healing. I like your theory, Amy.
That's my theory. I think they were good.
And green is the color of healing magic.
Green is good. So, yeah, that's my theory. I liked my theory. And honestly, I had that theory while I was watching the movie. But in the movie, he like falls into like the pod thing that has like the dead guy in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, maybe not. And then they strap him down and they throw a blanket over him and it calms him down. And I'm like, okay, they're being good.
And then it suctions.
And then it suctions him down, and then they shoot the needle in his eye. And I was like, these aren't good guys. But it would also make sense why there might be a poke on his arm. You know?
Give him an IV or something?
Yeah, I mean, either that or maybe that's where... Because anybody who's struck by lightning usually has an entrance and an exit wound.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, we're talking a week afterwards, so he very well could have been unconscious for...
Yeah.
You know, a week. And then, or I guess 5 days. A work week. And then, you know, when he finally started getting better, woke up. And that's why they let him go. He was healed. That was the only thing they wanted to do. They didn't care about keeping him.
They're like, throw him by the side of the road. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Exactly. We didn't hit him.
They didn't want to call the sheriff. Be like, oh, fuck, we hit somebody. And just like, fuck, just throw him to... We healed him. Throw him on the ground.
Like, oh, God, we just committed an intergalactic crime. We got to cover this up.
Oh, God.
Especially since the Pleiadiacs are like the head of the intergalactic order, right?
Could Klaas be in the employ of the Intergalactic League and not the United States federal government?
Could be.
Does it go bigger than I even thought?
He's a Men in Black.
No, I'm really starting to sound like a crackpot.
I don't think you could talk about aliens and not at some point in time sound like a crackpot.
That's the fun of it.
Exactly. That's why I love aliens. This is actually one alien case that didn't freak me out. Normally, alien cases give me the heebie-jeebies, and this one didn't.
Right.
So, it's kind of nice to not have the heebie-jeebies from an alien case.
Even though it was so scarily portrayed in the film.
Yeah. Well.
This is one of those that I just can't find anything that just makes me go, I don't believe it. Like, this one I can't debunk it or stand behind it. But from his writings and all the witness testimony and polygraphs, whether or not you want to say no good confirm or not, but I can't say one way or the other on it.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go ahead and believe him until I can debunk it.
I say, Travis believed it to the point that he was able to pass lie detector tests.
Yeah.
So, regardless, it's real to him.
Now, when he was talking on that show to Michael Shermer, I didn't really look into this, but he mentioned that there was like Geiger counter readings. That is evidence that something happened in that area. And then there was some other kind of readings they did. And he said, well, it's not physical evidence. It's scientific readings. And that's evidence, you know?
Yeah.
But I couldn't find any more information on it.
I might have to go pull up a geological survey of the area and look at the limestone deposits. Because that's kind of my theory that I'm on right now, is that they somehow suck energy out of the earth to power their ships.
Yeah.
Kind of like we're like a refueling station, really kind of along their way.
And that was interesting when we were digging into that case. Every coordinate listed had that in the geographical survey.
Yeah.
You remember the element?
It was limestone deposit or sediment deposits.
Yeah.
And like we talked about how limestone is known in the paranormal field to hold energy and store energy.
We got the idea that maybe like they're actually portals instead
of...
Like
limestone batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Very interesting. Very fun case. Very good movie.
Yeah. All around, I liked the Travis Walton case. I think the Travis Walton case is far less upsetting than the Barney and Betty Hill one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I think Travis has done well for himself. I mean, relatively well for himself since it happened.
Yeah.
He's still alive. He still does documentaries. He still does interviews.
Mm-hmm.
It seems it's weird that, you know, someone who, like, you could, to me, it makes, I can't string words together. That you can tell he wasn't trying to make money off of it because he was still getting a regular job and still trying to work.
And his story has never changed over the entire course of events. The story has stayed the same, which to me adds credibility to the story.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's kind of like when we talked about the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine. They lost credibility for me because their stories wouldn't stay the same.
Yeah.
You know, so the fact that his story has stayed the same is pretty impressive.
I think so. Regardless if you believe Travis Walton's story or not, Travis Walton believes, and he has spent decades defending his story. Despite the mockery, despite the ridicule, despite the character assassinations, he chose to stick with his story no matter what obstacles he faced. To this day, Travis Walton speaks at UFO conferences and helps, and is helped by a great community of people that lean on each other and attempt to heal and live. Despite the cruelness and intentions of some people in this world, those that cannot stand what other people choose to believe.
I like this case a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll do it for our Travis Walton. This has been a long episode.
Thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah. Thank you for reading us the book, Dave.
Dave.
Purely just excerpts from it. It's a pretty long book. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of pages. A lot of details. A lot of scientific evaluations in it and things like that.
Yeah. It's such an interesting case. I'm glad we covered it.
Yeah.
If you have any stories you want us to cover, if you know any alien stories that you want us to dig into, send us an email, message us on Instagram or Facebook. Our email is umpnormalcy@gmail.com. Our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter are at umpnormalcy. And of course, our website, you can also submit on there, and that's umpnormalcy.com. If you've got cryptid cases you want us to cover, send us some information. We love listener requests, and that's one of our favorites, I think, to do, is listener requests, because a lot of them we haven't ever heard of, so it's fun to learn. And until next time,
keep digging.